That's the thing. As I'm reading, every so often I'd come upon something and I'd think to myself, wow, so that's how they do it. But then again, my immediate subsequent thought was, well, they could just be writing to throw us off track. So you really don't know.
That was Gary Rosman. He's one of our listener readers, and he sat down with me to talk about the latest James Patterson book, The President is Missing. It's what we're reading. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. In this hour-long edition of What We're Reading, we'll hear about the Great American Read Project put on by PBS. I sit down with a listener reader and talk books. We'll be talking about The President is Missing, the new political thriller written by James Patterson and former President Bill Clinton. Author Jill Santopolo talks about love and loss and compromise in her latest novel, The Light We Lost. And we'll learn more about the history of the road trip with writer Richard Rattay, his latest book, Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip. Our thanks to the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota, celebrating the past, present, and future of iron mining in Minnesota. More about mines and supporting businesses at TechKnight.org. '84, Game of Thrones, Alice's Adventure in Wonderland, The Color Purple, The Da Vinci Code, Jane Eyre, 50 Shades of Grey. What do these books have in common? They're on the list of America's 100 best-loved novels, and you get to vote for your favorites. It's part of a project from PBS, The Great American Read, an 8-part series that explores and celebrates the power of reading. Here's a clip from the first episode.
A reader lives 1,000 lives before he dies. A man who does not read lives only one.
The way we communicate to each other is by stories.
I'm so grateful that my mother felt it was such an integral part of enriching our lives.
Imagination is probably one of the most important gifts humans have.
You can go visit countries that you've never been to before.
Experience the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat.
Swashbuckling and swords and castles.
Those words are doing things. They're conjuring imagery. They're accessing your emotions.
I just love great books.
I talked with Bill Gardner, the Vice President of Programming and Development at PBS, to find out more about this exciting project.
What we try to do more and more at PBS is look for projects that can make use of our entire system. You know, we're made up of over 300 local stations and partnerships in the community. So if we can find a project that is really custom fit for that local national interaction, we jump on it. And this project came along. It was pitched to us by a production company to try to find the most loved novel in America and really use that as a vessel to get people reading and talking about literature and books and so forth. So it was a fun way to really energize our entire system and have some really compelling content out of it as well.
Now, you've come up with a list of 100 novels, and I have to admit, I was pretty surprised when I saw some of the titles on there. Some of them I thought were, you know, classics, and I expected that, but there were some newer works of fiction that I was pretty surprised at. So can you explain how that list was created?
Sure. You know, that's not PBS's list. That's the American public's list. We worked with YouGov to conduct a poll. It was demographically representative of the population of the United States. And we just asked one question, what's your most loved book? And these are the responses that we got across the over 12,000 respondents, I think was the number. And we ranked them in order. And these are the top, pretty much the top 100. And this is the choices of American readers. You know, it's also why it goes to most loved. It's not about the best or the most influential or the most important or what have you. It's the most loved. So there's a lot of variety in there, which is it's an interesting thing to see what Americans like to read. Teenagers are reading one book. people in their 20s and 30s or other books. And, you know, it just goes all the way through your age. Different books speak to you at different times in your life. And I think that's what's fun about the project. It's really about exploring reading and exploring books and getting people talking about them and why they like them and for what reason.
Now, how can people participate in this?
Well, the most important thing is to read, you know, read the books. But we have a website called, it's at pbs.org/The Great American Read, and there's lots of content that's there. There's information about the authors, about the books, but the biggest thing is you go to that page and you can vote. Each book you can vote for one time per day, but you can vote for as many books as you want to because we all have more than one favorite book, I think. And then on our Facebook page, the PBS Facebook page, and we have a dedicated one for The Great American Read, there's lots of interactivity you can do. There's a book club, actually, I think has 40,000 members right now that's just talking about the books they're reading. So there's lots of ways to get involved at that level. And also in your local markets, I know up where you guys are, there's some really good public television stations, and they're involved in it. They're having activities, events, your local library, bookstores. Keep an eye out for any kind of signage or what have you, or events that are going on in your community, and come and check it out.
And I understand that there is a book about this that's already been published?
It's the Book of Books, yep. And what that is, it's kind of a collection of little pieces about each of the books on the list, why, what their influence was, kind of plot synopses, when they came out, and so forth. It's a nice way to kind of get into seeing what Americans are reading and learn a bit more about them.
And all of this is going to kind of culminate into a winner. This is why you want people to go on and vote.
Sure. You know, we announced the list back in May, and all summer there have been a lot of events in the local communities, and voting has been taking place all summer. And then it really gets going again in September when we relaunch the big fall kickoff show that reprises what we're doing, lists out the books that are on the list, and shows some of the things that have taken place over the summer. And then each week after that, the books are organized kind of according to themes. So the next week is the episode title is Who Am I? And that's a collection of books about identity and self-realization and so forth. And then we do an episode on heroes, another one on villains and monsters, then we do What We Do for Love, and then Other Worlds. So it's a way to get into a lot of these books in more detail from that point of view. And what we want to do as it goes along is just get people involved in talking and voting for things so that when we get to the finale that airs on October 23rd, we'll do a bit of a countdown, but the countdown will be throughout some of the genres or what people in certain parts of the country liked, that sort of thing, culminating in the announcement of who got the most votes. Now, there's no trophy, there's no prize or anything like that, but there will be a winner. But we really want to celebrate many of the books that Americans chose to read and are really excited about. So we'll go do deeper dives on probably the top 10 to really talk about why people chose those and voted for them. And there's activities in social media that are impacting how the totals are coming together because fan bases get really energized. So if you're a fan of one of these books, get out there and vote for it because, you know, every voice counts. And, you know, we'll talk about all of that. It's really a celebration of reading and the books on the list more than trying to crown a single winner, although there will be one.
That's Bill Gardner, Vice President of Programming and Development at PBS. Visit pbs.org for a link to the Great American Read page. You can also find a link on our website at kaxe.org. On the Great American Read page, you will be able to view the list of 100 books, information on how to vote, and episodes from the series. Remember, you have until October 17th to cast your vote for your most beloved books. So check it out. It's really quite an interesting list. And you can get your kids involved, too. There's a lot of children's books on that list, like Little Women, Charlotte's Web, The Chronicles of Narnia, and of course Harry Potter is on there as well. Everyone is sure to find a favorite here.
Thank you.
You're listening to What We're Reading on KAXE KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. And next up, I get to do one of my most favorite things. I sit down with a listener reader and talk about books. Gary Rosman is the executive director of the Beltrami County Historical Society, and we are going to talk about one of his summer reads. All right, Gary, let's talk about this book.
Hello, thanks for having me. So the book I've just finished reading is called The President is Missing, and it's co-authored by Bill Clinton and James Patterson. And I would describe it as a sort of techno-thriller, perhaps you might say, in the style of Dan Brown or someone of that sort. I'm not a James Patterson fan, truth be told. I picked it up strictly because of his writing partner in this case. I just thought that it was such an interesting concept, this collaboration that they were teaming up for.
A president writing about a president.
Exactly, yeah. So it just seemed neat. I'm not necessarily opposed to the genre. It's not my usual, I'll admit. I read a lot of history, philosophy, poetry, things like that. But this was this was perfect for the summer. It was kind of breezy reading. I enjoyed it. Overall, I'd give it a thumbs up. But of course, it has its pros and cons, like any work of art.
Okay, why don't you give us a quick plot?
So, as the title implies, The President is Missing is about the current occupant of the White House. His name is Duncan, President Duncan in this case. And the plot revolves around potential cyber terrorism and the country's infrastructure, electronic infrastructure is at stake. And so the president has to take it upon himself to ride off and save the day. I'll say this much. It's kind of... It almost doesn't apply in the sense that at every point in the story, you know very well where the president is. But I guess from the perspective of the fictional public in this book, they are unaware. So it's very fast-paced. There are stretches of two or three pages even where every page is a new chapter. So it goes, it's an easy read. It goes by quick. And so that's why I think it would be enjoyable for your beach reading. It does require a fair amount of a suspension of disbelief.
Without giving out too much about the ending,
yeah.
Did it come to a satisfying ending for you?
Oh, yeah, I would say so. Some interesting things about the book, and one of the things I'll mention is the excerpt that I posted online, which is, I think, how happened to become aware that I read it. It was what caught my eye was the mention of Paul Bunyan on page 42. That was interesting.
What was the context of Paul Bunyan?
Well, they're talking about the president's facial hair and how the resemblance is close. If you'll permit me, I have another short excerpt.
Sure.
And this is a poem of sorts to set the scene for you. They're talking about the president and the future president and future first lady's courtship. And this was a love letter of sorts. "You're here to study," says my buddy. "Remember, Professor Waite. But for some reason, I just can't concentrate. I'm reading the section on equal protection, the law and racial quotas, but instead I'm thinking of a green-eyed girl from Minnesota."
Aww.
Yes. And he even goes on to say how difficult it was to rhyme the word Minnesota.
That's true.
A few other things, that interesting things that jumped out at me. The authors both made a valiant effort to try to keep contemporary politics out of the equation. And that's something that was always sort of in the back of my mind. How deeply are they going to go into mimicking the current political climate?
This is because this is fairly new.
This published this year, very, very recently, indeed, yes. And one of the tactics they employ, for example, is to always refer to our party and the opposing party. They never actually state definitively what that party is. So it's very kind of kept cryptic like that. Although by the end, again, without giving away too much. There is a particular speech that is given, which I think removes all doubt about, not that you're really ever questioning being Bill Clinton, right, being a Democrat. But I don't think it was necessarily a political polemic. It was, you know, when it comes down to it, after all is said and done, an adventure story. But as I mentioned, at the end, there's a transcription of a speech, and it sort of reminded me, I guess I would say, perhaps of a Oscar acceptance speech when the award recipient gets on their little soapbox, right? It's not inappropriate. It doesn't really have much to do with the task at hand, the awarding of prizes. But it's a platform, and this book was indeed a platform for him. So
when I read books like that, one of the things that intrigues me is getting that kind of insider scoop on how things work. Did this provide you any kind of like background on what goes on in the White House?
Right. Well, you know, that's the thing. As I'm reading, every so often I'd come upon something and I'd think to myself, wow, so that's how they do it. But then again, my immediate subsequent thought was, well, they could just be writing to throw us off track. So you really don't know.
Right.
Because, again, it's fiction. This wasn't, you know, the National Geographic Guide to the White House or anything like that. I would love if that had been. But it's interesting. It's fun. It was fun to kind of imagine that those things are true.
Okay, you're finished with this book, but what are you going to be reading next?
I have just picked up, this is a couple of years old, but fairly recent. It's by David Green. It's called Midnight in Siberia, subtitled A Train Journey into the Heart of Russia. And this is due to my budding interest in all things train related. And that's because of my work at the Great Northern Depot here in Bemidji. And so I'm eager to crack open that.
Well, I can't wait to hear what you think about that.
Let me know if you'd like me to return. I'd be happy to tell
I think
you what
I will.
Thought.
This is What We're Reading on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. So, weird question. Have you ever left a copy of Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale in a hotel room? If so, you're not alone. According to Travel and Leisure magazine, The Handmaid's Tale was the number one most abandoned book in the Travelodge chain, followed by The Couple Next Door by Sherry LaPena and Bad Dad by David Wallums. So the big question is, does this list say more about these books or the people who left them? I'll leave that for you to decide. Go to our KAXE, KBXE What We're Reading page on Facebook. Let us know the weird places you've lost or left your books. The only books I've lost are the ones that I've loaned out. You know who you are. Still to come, author Richard Ratay on the history of the road trip. Up next, writer Jill Santopolo and a modern romance. There are great classic works on romance. Some are usually pretty dark, involve some dark, moody, Byronic hero in some dark, moody setting. There's loss, there's tragedy and melodrama, and maybe that's why people really like them. Others are too tidy. Happily Ever After seems too easy. But let's talk about the modern romance. Romance in the age of social media, an age when women have more choices in how they want to live their lives, career or children or both. But what do we give up when we make these choices? Writer Jill Santopolo explores this in her novel, The Light We Lost. Her characters, Lucy and Gabe, meet in college and fall madly in love, but career choices tear them apart. Lucy painfully moves on and meets steady and safe Darren, and they eventually get married and start a family. But a tragedy forces Lucy to reflect on the choices that brought her to this point in time. I talked with Jill about compromise and the choices in this novel, but we started our conversation with the question, does first love and loss transcend boundaries of time, even in a modern romance?
I think that the idea of a first love, of someone who sees you for who you are and loves you because of it, you know, is something that has been happening to people since the beginning of time. And I think that losing someone you love has also, you know, in various different ways been happening to people since the beginning of time. So I think that love and loss in that sense are completely timeless, and that's at the heart of the story, I think.
Running through this story is also the idea of choices and paths that we take. Lucy ends each chapter questioning what would have happened if we had gone this way or if I had said yes or I had said no. Do you want to talk about choices and pathways, how you use that in this story?
Yeah, throughout the story, Lucy is wondering whether it's fate or free will that has brought them together and kept her and Gabe in contact all of these years. And, you know, I think that what she kind of ends up with, and I think probably where I am on this question too, is that, you know, there are things that happen in life over which we have no control, but we do have control over the way we respond to them. And I think in that sense, you know, there are some events in Lucy's life that just happen, and then there are some events that, and then, you know, she makes choices based on those things. So perhaps it's part fate and part free will, if those things that happen to her are indeed fated or just maybe seem fated after the fact.
Lucy eventually gets over her relationship with Gabe enough that she is able to open herself up to Darren, who she mm-hmm. eventually becomes more involved with. What makes Lucy and Darren work in a way that Lucy and Gabe didn't work?
Part of Gabe's character is that the thing that is most important in his life is his career and his passion for his career. So since that's most important, Lucy can't be most important because you can only have one thing that's most important. I think when she meets Darren, she finds someone for whom his relationship with her is the most important. And I think that is really special to her, that there's someone in this world who cares about her and cares about the two of them as a team basically more than anything else. And I think that solidity and stability and dedication makes her and Darren work in a way that she and Gabe couldn't, because she wasn't the most important thing in his world.
Lucy makes reference to her mother having a career but deciding to raise children instead, and kind of that, maybe that's again going back to that choice thing, but I was really struck by how Lucy recognized that and how she didn't really want to go down that path, and she was able to have children and have her career. And so I was struck by how she recognized that in her own mother and was able to work that out for herself. And I was glad for that.
I always think it's interesting when you write a first-person book like this, where, you know, the narrator is Lucy. And what she says about her mom is that, you know, her mother gave up this career and gave up her identity as a lawyer and instead took on the identity of Lucy's mom or Jason's mom or Don's wife and was defined by her relationship to somebody else, not for who she was on her own, and that Lucy very much wants to be defined as her own self, not always in relation to someone else. I think it would be interesting to ask Lucy's mom kind of why she made the choices she made and how she ended up that way, and what she thinks about what her daughter took away from her life. I haven't really thought about the answer to that, but part of the story is how Lucy interprets her mother's decision and then how she makes her own decisions based on her interpretation.
You mention in the acknowledgments that the story was inspired by events in your own life. Was this a work of catharsis for you?
It was actually. Yeah, I started writing the book after I went through a horrible breakup, and I think, you know, was able to work through what I was feeling while writing the story. And I think that while Lucy is not me and the plot point by plot point, this is not my story at all, I do think the book ended up being emotionally autobiographical because a lot of the emotions that Lucy experiences were things I was experiencing and trying to figure out and navigate as I was writing the story in my real life as well.
You're listening to our conversation with author Jill Santopolo. It's What We're Reading here on KAXE KBXE. Jill's latest novel is The Light We Lost, a story of love and loss, and the choices we make that lead us on our own journeys. Jill is the author of several children's and young adult books, and The Light We Lost is her first adult novel. I asked her if this was an easy transition.
I didn't find the transition that difficult, mostly because I feel like I get sort of into the mind of my characters, or I try to at least. So the words that I use or the things that I talk about or the images that I reach for are the ones that I feel my characters would go after. So when I'm writing as a 10-year-old, I sort of limit my mind to thinking in the space of a 10-year-old, like how would a 10-year-old look at this or see this or compare this to what or interpret that situation, whereas here with an adult novel, I was doing the same process, but I was just thinking, well, what would a 35-year-old think about this or that or the other thing? When I was younger and through college and slightly after college, I did a bunch of theater. So I feel like all of the acting training that I got has come through for me in fiction writing.
The 9/11 attack is obviously a big part of our American history now. How did you approach using that in the story? Is it not even something that you give a second thought to because it's an event that is just part of our lives? Or was there a conscious effort to incorporate this in?
Well, so I, like the characters, I was at Columbia University on September 11th, 2001. I was in a Shakespeare lecture while the planes hit the Twin Towers, and we just kept having class and nobody knew what had happened until we left the classroom and it seemed like the world had, you know, been turned on its ear and everything was scary and everyone was horrified and, you know, we were, 7 miles from the site of the Twin Towers, so we were all really, really shaken. And I think that especially for my friends and I who were in New York City that day, but I think for a lot of people who are around the same age that I was, that, you know, the September 11th attacks were a really just pivotal moment in my life, in that it made me look at the world differently. It made me look at what could happen differently, and it made me really realize that there is no guarantee for a tomorrow. So you've got to make today count because you just don't know what's going to happen. And a lot of my friends sort of decided, you know, I'm going to be a journalist, I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to be a lawyer, and I'm going to help people. I'm going to go into politics on or right after September 11th because it really just shook them in that way and made them reevaluate or evaluate what they wanted to do and how they wanted to spend their lives, knowing that, you know, we don't have forever. And I think that's when I really reaffirmed the fact, and I'd always kind of known it, but reaffirmed the fact that I wanted to write children's books because I wanted to be able to affect the way the future saw the world. And, you know, I think that kind of morphed into writing adult novels where talking about what humanity all has in common, you know, is part of what I've been trying to do, at least, and you know, give people a way to connect. We all love, we all lose, no matter where we're from or how old we are or how we were raised or, you know, what religion we practice or what language we speak. And I think that because that moment was so pivotal, that day was so pivotal and meant so much in my life, as I know it did in so many other people's lives, I thought it made sense for the story to start here and change the way Lucy and Gabe looked at the world.
There's moments in life that catch you off guard. Moments you just can't discard. They're with you always till the end of your days. Commendable, unmendable scars. He spoke his sons' names as they started to cry. They cried tears of yellow.
You're listening to What We're Reading on KAXE KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski.
Trailers for sale or rent, rooms to let, 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of pushing broom by the 8x12 4-bedroom. I'm a
man of means by no means, king of the road.
Third box call, midnight train, a destination banger, man. Oh, worn out suit and shoes, I don't pay no union dues. I smoke
old stogies I have found, short but not too big around.
I'm a man of means by no means, king of the road. I know every engineer on every train, and all of their children and all of their names, and every
that ain't locked when no one's around to sing. Trailers
for sale. The summer may be winding down, but there's still time to pack up the car and hit the open road, destination known or unknown. I have vivid memories of my family's road trips when I was a kid. We'd pile into my dad's pickup truck, mom and dad in the front, me and my three brothers and maybe a dog or two, bumping and sliding around in the back on a pile of sleeping bags and blankets. I know what you're thinking, but it was a different time safety-wise. So I was excited when I heard about a new book, Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip, written by Richard Rattay. This new book is full of facts and short histories of just about every aspect of the road trip, from the roads themselves to the cars to the ways we pass time on long trips, food, rest stops, CB radios, motels, and more. Here he tells us how he came up with the idea for this book.
Well, I know this may shock you, Tammy, but the idea for writing a book about family vacations actually came to me while on a family vacation. Mm-hmm. Now, my dirty little secret is that time we actually weren't on a road trip. We'd flown somewhere, but I was sitting in a beach chair, and I looked over at my sons, who were 6 years old and 8 years old at the time, and I got back to thinking about what my life was like when I was their age and traveling the highways of the 1970s and 80s with my siblings and parents. And it occurred to me that, you know, those experiences were really profound and impacted me in so many ways. They provided many of my fondest childhood memories. They broadened my horizons in so many ways, of course, as a, you know, as a kid exploring different areas of America, trying the different foods of different regions of the country, and hearing Americans speak very differently, you know, with thick accents in different areas of the country. And also those long hours of travel really shaped my relationships with my parents and with my siblings profoundly for a lifetime. They really brought us close together. But it also occurred to me how little I knew about how
the great American road trip experience came to be. I didn't know things like really how America got its roads and interstate highway system. I didn't know how we got some of the devices in our car, like cruise control and fuzz busters, and you know how police got their radar guns and why we had 8-track tape decks, or why our family station wagon had fake wood paneling on the sides. So when I got back from that vacation, I went over to the local library. I read book after book. I did more research online. And what I found absolutely fascinated me. And at the end of my research, and I spent almost a year doing research for this book, I had such a wealth of material that I knew I had the stuff to write a great book.
What's one of the most interesting aspects of the road trip that you did discover in this wealth of research?
Yeah, one of the most surprising things to me is how young America's interstate highway system really is. Of course, President Eisenhower approved legislation which began funding and construction of the highway system in 1956. But really, it took America, 25 years to actually complete the interstate highways that legislation funded. And just a few of the things that have been around longer than the interstate system, the first of our interstate highways, things like color TV, barcodes, microwave ovens. Queen Elizabeth II has been Queen of England longer than America has had its first interstate highway system. David Hasselhoff is older than America's interstate highway system. So that was just mind-blowing to me to find out, because when I was a kid and out on those interstates actually traveling with my family, you kind of take them for granted. You think those are things that have just kind of been around forever. But really, America was still constructing those interstates at the same time that we were out traveling them during the 1970s and 80s.
Give us an idea of what early road trips were like then. Who were some of the pioneers of early road trips?
Well, if we're going back to like the first motorist to cross America, that would be a gentleman by the name of Horatio Jackson. He made his attempt in 1903, and that attempt began, as many bad ideas do, after having a couple of drinks and making a bet with somebody. So Horatio Jackson was a doctor from Vermont. And he was out there with his new bride, but he goes out drinking with a friend one evening at San Francisco's University Club, and he soon finds himself in a heated debate with another patron over the question of whether cars were the future of transportation or just a passing fad. He asserts that automobiles are already so rugged and reliable, I could drive one clear across the country back to my home in Vermont. But Jackson goes about things the right way. He hired a young mechanic by the name of Sewell Crocker. On Crocker's recommendation, Jackson buys a high-quality 20-horsepower Winton touring car. The two of them load up the car with camping equipment, and they set off. And about 15 miles in, they blow their first tire, which requires them to use their only spare. Of course, a few miles after that, they blow two more tires and have to wind up the wheels, the rims of the wheels in thick rope just so that they can keep making progress to help. A little while after that, they get bad directions from a woman who sends them 100 miles out of their way just because she wants some of her extended family members to get their first look at an automobile. Of course, they were still pretty rare back then. They proceed to run out of gas. They have to buy a spotlight to mount to the hood of their car so that they can keep traveling after dark. And all of this has happened before the two of them are really off the West Coast. But somewhere along the line, they pick up a stray pit bull by the name of Bud, and he seems to change their luck. They're traveling along, and some of the dust is getting kicked up, and it gets in Bud's eyes, and they notice that his eyes are welling up with tears. So they outfit him in a pair of goggles. Well, the press just loves this, and they begin turning out at whatever cities that Jackson is going to arrive to, and they take pictures of Bud in his goggles and Crocker and Jackson. And gradually, as they get east of the Mississippi River, all of a sudden there's more improved roads for them to travel on. The going gets easier. And 63 days later, Jackson and Crocker and the pit bull Bud become the first motorists to roll into Times Square and becoming the first to have crossed America by car.
You're listening to KAXE KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Richard Ratay's new book, Don't Make Me Pull Over, is full of fun and interesting facts about all things road trips, like CB radios. We had those growing up. Here, Richard describes some history behind them and the fun CB radio vocabulary.
CB radios really became popular in the 1970s because of the oil crisis in 1973. People had their CB radios. Well, as a result of the oil crisis, of course, President Nixon passed the national maximum speed limit of 55 miles per hour, which was substantially slower than many highways had their limits set at that time. And the goal of it, of course, was to help America conserve fuel. You don't use quite as much fuel when you're traveling at 55 miles per hour as opposed to 70 miles per hour. So CB radios became popular because people wanted to keep each other updated on the whereabouts of, you know, what they called smokies at that time, or law enforcement officers, speed patrol officers. And of course, they wanted to be able to locate which gas stations actually had gas. It was a real fuel shortage in America, and gas stations were often running out of gas. So they used CB radios to keep updated on all that. Well, there was a certain lingo associated with the use of CB radios. It was kind of a combination of police 10 codes and military jargon and just some good old Southern slang. And it became incredibly popular in the 1970s among just about everybody, especially kids, to be using this CB jargon. So they'd refer to, you know, speed patrol officers, of course, as Smokies, which was a reference to the Smokey the Bear spokes animal, I guess, that was, you know, talking about forest fire prevention in those days. You know, if there was a Smokey up ahead that had a radar gun out, he was called a Kojak with a Kodak, or a hemorrhoid with a Polaroid, more colorfully. The highway itself was referred to as the Super Slab. Ambulances were called meat wagons. And so there was all this colorful jargon associated with CB radios, and it kind of made its way into popular vernacular, so that even, you know, businessmen were closing out conversations with each other saying 10-4, good buddy, and keep on trucking, and things like that. And these were people, of course, who had never been anywhere near a semi-truck in their lives, but it just became part of popular culture.
I think one of the most universal situations of the road trip with a family is fighting amongst siblings after long hours of being stuck in the car. You get antsy, you get bored, and then you do what kids and siblings would do. You get into trouble. There's an incident that you share that I think describes this perfectly. Would you read that for us?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, I think I know just the one you are referring to. Like all kids, I needed to be provided with an endless stream of diversions, or I'd begin inventing my own, usually involving singing, humming, or some other noisy annoyance. This would begin a predictable series of events, the first of which would be my receiving a swift noogie from one of my brothers. I would respond by bawling hysterically, prompting my dad to snarl, "Don't make me pull over," and angrily throw his right arm over the front seat to grab the neck of my assailant while struggling to maintain control of the steering wheel with his left hand. He'd veer onto the shoulder, causing my mom to begin screaming at my dad to mind his driving before he got us all killed, at which point my sister would curl into a fetal position in preparation for impact. Just in the nick of time, Dad would swerve back onto the road, and we'd continue on our way. Having barely escaped death, we'd all sit in stunned silence for the next 20 minutes as though none of it had ever happened. On most trips, this would play out a dozen times a day.
That is so true. And yet we continue to go on these road trips. What's wrong with us?
You know what? I think there's magic to sharing these kind of experiences together. Really, that's what road trips were about, was families enjoying time together and making discoveries together and facing adversity together. And these were experiences that could only be found and encountered by traveling through America in a car rather than flying over America in an airplane.
Now that you have your own family, have you taken some road trips?
Oh, absolutely. We continue to take road trips to this day. And in fact, you know, when I was growing up with my own family, and we rarely traveled, east of the Mississippi River. So I'm making up for that today. We're doing lots of traveling west of the Mississippi. We've been out traveling that great traditional route along I-90 through South Dakota on our way to Yellowstone. And we've been out to Devil's Tower out there. We've been out there several times and stopped at those great places like the Corn Palace and the Walt Drug, and stopping off at the Badlands, and the Minuteman Missile Historic Site was one of my favorite stops along that route. So I've kind of made up for, you know, all those trips that we didn't do in my youth with my present family. And luckily, we've always traveled with my boys. They're now 14 and 12 years old. They're great travelers. And so we still, to this day, very much enjoy taking road trips together.
Go, drove to Chicago. All things know, we sold our clothes to the state. I don't mind, I made a lot of mistakes in my mind.
Oh,
This is What We're Reading on KAXE KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski, and we've got a lot of book recommendations from our community online. Andrea just finished reading Exotic Stories for Punjabi Widows by Bali Jaswal. Andrea says it was excellent. Carolyn recommends Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest by Adam Arvidsson. Carolyn says this is a good description of the work and ongoing research to understand and preserve Minnesota's endangered species. Wendy has read Helene Wecker's The Golem and the Genie. It takes place mostly in the turn of last century New York, with mythical characters from different immigrant communities trying to negotiate living in the human form. They're excited for the sequel, which will hopefully be coming out later this year, titled The Iron Season. If you'd like to join in on our conversation about books, head on over to our KAXE KBXE What We're Reading page on Facebook, where you can tell us what you're reading and get great recommendations from other readers. Thanks to Gary Rosman for talking books with me today. We heard music from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Tree Party, Steelism, and Sufjan Stevens. Music from the Roger Miller tribute album, lots of country greats on that track. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Thanks for tuning in. What We're Reading is made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.